One of the biggest productivity hurdles is losing your data. Your computer crashes, you haven't backed stuff up, you've been meaning to, but you just never got around to it. That's where CrashPlan comes in. CrashPlan has been around since 2001, and they're a pioneer provider of cloud-based data protection and recovery services, both to individuals and businesses. And I guess ultimately, you've got to ask yourself, how much are your ideas worth, especially when you lose them? Whether it's a business plan, your images, your spreadsheets, your audio files, any of the files you use to work or manage your home. They've got options for everyone from solo creators to growing businesses. CrashPlan works efficiently in the background while you work, encrypting and sending all your new or changed files to their secure cloud every 15 minutes. And then if something happens to your files, your hard drive crashes, your cat knocks over a cup of coffee onto your laptop, or you just accidentally delete a file, your files are just a click away. CrashPlan makes it simple to restore some or all of your data with unlimited version retention. CrashPlan is your ultimate rewind button. Don't let data disasters slow you down. CrashPlan has your back and keeps you moving. Go to crashplan.com/beyond for 50% off your first year of CrashPlan. That's crashplan.com/beyond for 50% off your first year. Back up better with CrashPlan. And welcome back to Beyond the To-Do List, a podcast about productivity. I'm Eric Fisher, your host, as we discuss the true goal of productivity, living a more meaningful life. And in this conversation this week, I am talking with Carlos Alvarenga. He is the author of the book, The Rules of Persuasion, How the World's Greatest Communicators Convince, Inspire, Lead, and Sometimes Deceive. We're not going to lean into that deceive part, but we'll investigate it a little bit just to make sure you're aware of that possibility. But as you might have guessed, we are talking about communication and more specifically, persuasion. We're going to understand that persuasion is about forming a community with common beliefs, not just about changing minds, telling people they should think a certain way. We're going to consider Aristotle's three persuasion factors and dive into each of those three, as well as subtopics in those three. We're also going to distinguish between persuasion and manipulation or coercion, dive into ethics a little bit there. All the while, we're going to recognize that the role of language is potent, and it's a tool that can be used for both good and harm, and I think you'll know the difference. So, I'm going to get out of the way and just say, enjoy this conversation with Carlos Alvarenga. Well, this week, it is my privilege to welcome to the show Carlos Alvarenga. Carlos, welcome to Beyond the To-Do List.
Eric, thank you for being on. It's a pleasure to be here with you and your listeners.
Thank you so much. So, persuade me as to the power of persuasion. A lot of people hear that word and they think, oh no, you're going to try and hypnotize me with words into doing something I don't necessarily want to do, but you want me to do. That's probably a popular misconception you've probably heard or something along those lines. You've been studying this, or I should say you've been studying ancient Greek and other things along those lines. So you've got a backbone and a great experience with this, but what is your definition of persuasion and even the power behind that?
Yes, it's an interesting place to start the conversation because I think that, well, I'll tell you why I wrote the book. And that was a few years ago, I started volunteering with nonprofit. I was coaching, I still coach CEOs and founders of nonprofits. And I was looking for a book on persuasion. So I ordered, I think, two or three from Amazon. But when I read them, I realized they weren't about persuasion. They were about influence or manipulation or negotiation or psychology. And I wasn't looking for that. I was looking for a book about the word persuasion. And what does it really mean? Because to me, persuasion is getting someone to willingly believe something. And so I couldn't find it. So I went back to a book I'd read in college called The Rhetoric by the philosopher Aristotle, which is about persuasion. And I began there. And so my book is an attempt to explain the Aristotelian model and to update it with examples and case studies from, you know, our era, right? So persuasion for Aristotle is defined the following way. It is a demonstration that something is true or appears to be true. Full stop. That's it. All right. Now, why is it important? And what do I think about this? I don't think it's about getting people to do something. what I explain to people is that persuasion is more fundamental than that. And the example I use is, imagine that you love, I don't know, Jaws. Jaws is just crazy about Jaws. It's just like, it's the best movie ever made. It's amazing. The shark, Brody, Frey, like the mayor of the town. It's just so wonderful. And Spielberg never equaled Jaws. Now, you and I meet at an airport, and it comes up that I also think Jaws is the greatest movie ever made. At that instant, you and I become a community. We're bound by our love of Jaws, right? And this is what persuasion is about. We as human beings have a fundamental desire that people believe what we believe, that they love what we love, that they censure what we censure. And so that is what it is to me and why it's so important, because it is a basic human need to have others believe what we believe.
So it's not trying to get somebody to do something per se or to believe something. It's more get them to consider something that you consider to be the truth.
It's getting them to believe something. And so for the definition is that I don't have to change your mind. People don't persuade. Truth or the appearance of truth persuade. So as I tell people I work with, don't worry about how are you going to change someone's opinion. Worry about what you want them to believe, right? And have that very clear in your mind. And so that is the first step to being a persuasive communicator. And in his book, Aristotle says there are only three things that can persuade someone. It is the character of the person speaking or the communicator, and that could be a person, a school, a government, an institution, the arguments presented, things like evidence, logic, proofs, witnesses, etc. And then the emotion that the audience feels as they listen. That's it. And so in my book, I explained that he was talking about oral communication in his day and age, but I believe that it applies to anything. I have a whole chapter on social media. I talk about film, hip hop, art, paintings, literature in China, in antiquity, in present day. The rules work the same way wherever and whenever you are.
Well, and so speaking of that, the title is The Rules of Persuasion: How the World's Greatest Communicators Convince, Inspire, Lead, and Sometimes Deceive. And that's part of it. And I think that's the thing is, I think, again, people hear that word, you know, people get stuck in semantics sometimes. They get stuck on, though a word didn't usually or always mean a certain thing or have a certain connotation to it. For example, one that I find often that has trickiness or stickiness with this is the word manipulate, which is somewhat akin to the word persuade. Well, I can pick something up. I'm going to do this right now. I'm picking up the cover to my webcam. It's about the size of a quarter, and I magnetically put it on there to block when I'm not doing anything. Right now, I am holding it, but when I move it around in my hand, I am manipulating it. I am moving it. I am telling it what to do. I am manipulating it. But some people would say, well, you know, the word manipulate means you're forcing. That's the difference between manipulation and maybe the word coercion, right?
It's a very important distinction. And I'll take a step back to explain how I see persuasion and why it's called the rules. So what I explain to people in the book and when I do talk from the book is erase the idea that persuasion is quote unquote a soft skill, that it's some amorphous thing or some innate, either you're born with it or you don't. The metaphor I use throughout the entire book is persuasion is chemistry, chemistry with language. And so if we take any of these three things that Aristotle mentioned, because it's a strange thing about Aristotle, which is the more obvious something was, often the less he explained it. So he gives us these three terms, but doesn't really break it down for us. So I wanted to write to answer two questions in the book. One is, what do you mean by character, emotion, and argument? Number one. And number two, what is the process of persuasion? What does it mean that someone's actually persuaded? What is happening at that moment? I was really fascinated by that question. And so in the book, I say, if we take someone's character, we can break it into seven pieces. Where does it come from? Which I call origin. What is it connected to? Which I call associations. What sets did it belong to? Which I call categories, right? What do I know about its past? Which is called history. Then there are seven pieces to argument. Witnesses, proofs, logic, authorities, laws, etc. And then there are seven kinds of emotion. Positive, negative, religious, mystical, etc. These 21 pieces, I say, the best way to understand these 21 pieces is to go back to high school chemistry and think of them as the periodic table of persuasion. Every message I've ever looked at, and I've looked at thousands, is some combination of these 21 things. Now, what happens is that chemistry of language, like real chemistry, quote unquote, is amoral. I can make medicine. I can make poison. I can save your life with chemistry. I can take your life with chemistry. The same is true for language. I can use the rules to save you. I can use the rules to poison your soul. And so that is the reason why we used to study this. And after World War II, for various, it was taken out of the curriculum. And there are people who, when I was writing the book, who read early drafts and thought, you shouldn't write this book. These things were supposed to stay hidden and they should remain hidden. But I think of it as a vaccine, as inoculation. I think the best way to not get poisoned is to understand how these things work.
In other words, it can be dangerous. It's kind of like AI is kind of being talked about these days. I have less of a concern about what AI can or can't do. I have more of a concern of what people can choose to use it for.
Right. Now, the machine, what it does is augment. And in fact, I was just on a podcast with the CEO of an AI company. And I said, I don't like the word artificial. I don't like artificial tongues. I think it's augmented intelligence. So what I mean by that Google augmented our memory. I don't have to remember the 17th president of the U.S. because Google remembers for me. And I carry around this portable memory piece of my brain, which is very handy, right? Because by portable memory, that lots of other things, it books me tickets, but it also remembers the 17th president of the United States. Now along comes AI, ChatGPT, and it says, well, here's one more augmentation. I will read 3,000 novels in the blink of an eye. You don't have to. That's it. So far, anyway, that's what it does, right? Well, what does that mean? Well, that's up to you to figure out. But I'll read the novels for you. I'll be right back. I'm done. Okay. What do you want to know? So I see the interesting part is to your point, which is we are augmenting human intellectual capacity one step at a time, but it's still human intellectual capacity. That's to decide. We'll do it. If you spend any time with generative art, like on DALL-E, right? Or in this one, the Midjourney, you have to go step by step, what do you want? It's a six paragraph instruction of the image. It's not making it. You're envisioning it. It just puts the pieces together from everything that it's seen, right? But you're right. It is ultimately people. So far, anyway. Now, could that change? Maybe, but we're not there yet.
So I think one of the things people might have a little bit of apprehension, maybe the best word. Fear is probably overdoing it, but they're saying in their head, okay, Aristotle lived so long ago. Why would what he said then matter to us now when it comes to persuasion?
Well, for the same reason that Pythagoras figured out a triangle right about the same time, Pythagoras, right? He kind of got the triangle he got it right at the start. And it's still a triangle, right? And so there are some things the Greeks got right. A lot they got wrong, but some things they got right. They got right then, and it's still right today. And so just the way Pythagoras figured out the triangle has three sides, Aristotle figured out persuasion has three parts. And if there's a persuasion triangle, if you want to combine the two, right, tales, it had three sides in 400 BC. It had three sides in 500 BC. It has three sides in 2024.
Well, and if anything else, I think just the people that said, wait, you should keep this hidden, or I don't know if you should write this book, also resonates to the power of Aristotle's concepts of logos and pathos and ethos, like you're expanding/modernizing.
Exactly that. And people will use these three terms. And it's funny because if you go on LinkedIn and you put in those terms, you get a whole bunch of articles, but they don't say very much beyond quoting that structure. And that's the reason I wrote the book, because my question was, well, what do you mean, once again, right, by these three things? And how do they actually work? And so you're exactly right. The challenge becomes, how do those rules, right, how are they manifested today in 2024 in things like TikTok or Instagram, in today's political campaigns, right? The formulas, I talk about formulas all the time. The chemistry makes formulas, right? And so the formulas are old, but they're being applied in different settings, in different ways, and also at scale. This is different from Aristotle, which is that because you've got what I call persuasion factories that are human and both and automated, you can deliver millions and millions of messages in a blink of an eye. And that wasn't part of the original equation. It is today. The rules are the same, right? But the scope of it and the scale of it and the speed are much different.
It's on a massive scale now. But I think back to the presidential debate, the first one that was televised with John F. Kennedy and Nixon, and how that was a turning point. Actually, apply these rules to what was happening at that moment, and then let's jump ahead to social media.
Yeah. So I write about the debate as one of the pivotal moments in the history of video, right? In video, we're living at the end of video's primacy. For decades, video has had a uncontested validity. If he saw it happen on video, it must be true. And that's no longer the case. So that happened to hold our breath with Photoshop a couple decades ago. And now it's happening today in video. What happened at that moment is the issue of character, right? So as I mentioned, one of the things is character. And so the funny thing about the debate was people who heard it thought Nixon won. People who saw it thought Kennedy won. And what happened was that Kennedy's style and the associations that the audience make, two of the seven elements of character are style and association. Associations are things the audience connects you to, right? So what they saw when they saw Nixon, his style and his associations turned them off. What they saw when they saw Kennedy, style and associations, turned them on. And that's why he won people who saw and lost people who heard it, right? What they saw was a young, handsome, et cetera, stylish, right? Eloquent, et cetera. And they didn't see the same with Nixon. And that's what decided the event. It was style and associations that the audience was making at that moment in time. And that's why he won the election later on, at least in great part.
So then we fast forward, and you even just kind of alluded to it with Photoshop and also now with deep fakes when it comes to video. I've seen some of these and I think, oh, that looks real. And yet I can still, to a certain extent, tell, but we're getting to a place where we might not be able to tell anymore.
You're right. And that's why you have things like, I think it's called content authentication initiative, which is for photographs. So what happens is that there's a chip that's put into a camera. When the image is taken, it encodes almost like a fingerprint into that image that says it was taken at this GPS coordinates at this time with this camera. And so, and as long as that information hasn't been tampered with, it can appear, let's say in, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, can put the photograph knowing that that is the photograph that was taken by that photographer at that camera in that particular place. If it's been tampered with, I can't run it because something might've happened to it. So I do believe that, and I think about this a lot, is that two things will happen. One is technology will evolve. For example, there's a company called Otherweb, which is the podcast that was on, the CEO. And what they're doing is they're developing a platform that applies, his metaphor was like an information, like a contents label or food to a news story. So like this news story is 35% Republican, 12% Democrat. So the idea is that you get this ingredients menu, he called it. That's it. What was this story made from, right? So I think there's technology, but I also think that as human beings, we'll have to develop evolutionarily or enhance the part of our mind that is able to distinguish, to your point, something's not right. Like this photo of the Middleton where still somebody somewhere picked something up and then it all kind of blew up. I think we're going to get a lot better at that as a species.
Yeah. So you mentioned character, you mentioned style, you mentioned association. What are some of the other pieces that fall under that character category with the rules or the periodic table?
Yeah, right. So I'll mention two or three. One is the most important one, which is origin. So origin refers to where was the character from? What formed it, right? So for example, that could be, what did you go to school? And the more elite or more tribal the audience, the more important origin is. People who went to fancy schools care where you went to school. People who spent time in the military, if they were special forces, the fact that you were counts a lot, right? So our character has a shared origin, right? Very, very important. Another one is history. What do I know about your past? And the funny thing about history is that it works bi-directionally. And by that, I mean that you can persuade me because you reaffirm everything I know about your past. So I've heard that you're a philanthropist and we meet and you tell me that you're about to make a big donation and you're this very generous person, right? But it also works by completely negating your past. As, for example, when somebody who was a drug dealer goes to schools and talks against drug dealing, what have they done? They say, I was a drug dealer for 20 years. And because I was a drug dealer, now believe me that it's a bad thing. Right? It's this remarkable reversal. Or when somebody leaves a political party, I was a Democrat for 25 years. Now I'm a Republican. Can't trust Democrat anymore. So I'm forced. They force me to change parties, right? So this funny thing about, or Undercover Boss, the show where the CEO works as a line cook for a week and learns valuable lessons. You know, in that case, actually it's status, which I think I mentioned, which is status is the power of the speaker relative to the audience. So that's part of character. So who's more powerful, you or the listeners? Sometimes it works by reminding them that you're more powerful. Sometimes persuasion works because you give up authority to them. And you say, I could make the choice, but I won't. I'll let me decide. I think we should do this, but you know what? You make the call. That's the use of status, history, origin.
I know you mentioned style as well. I'm trying to think of what the other one is. I think language is another one that's missing maybe there from the seven.
Very important. So what words do you use? Do you use fancy words, simple words, lame words? Are you plain spoken, quote unquote, right? Are you fancy Ivy League language, right, quote unquote? So the words, like, do you use technical jargon? Do you use words that everybody understands? The common thing with professionals that they love jargon because it shows their origin. Jargon tells one audience, I'm part of you. I'm one of you. Language tells another audience, you're not one of us. The same word tells group A, I'm one of you. The same word tells group B, I'm not one of you. All right. So being careful about what words you use is really critical.
And so those all fall under character. And character is that kind of, it's almost the before I even say anything or as I'm starting to say something, those are all like hints and cues and context, in a sense, context of the person or the messenger.
Yeah, character in the sense, not of your good or bad character, character in the sense of a character that I see in a movie, right? You've seen these pictures of the old Greek classic plays that have like a smiling, right, or a kind of frowning face, right? The character that you're playing, that the audience sees. These seven elements define who and what the audience sees that is communicating.
Perfect. That's a great way to frame it, because I think some people would say character meaning your ethics, you know, if you're good or bad, or intent, in other words. But that's not what it is.
Right. Character isn't in your dramatic sense.
Still searching for a great candidate for your company? Don't search, just match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch that busy work. Instead, use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. I wish I had Indeed when I was in the hiring process in roles in the past, because it is a slow, arduous headache of a process to find the right people, or at least it used to be. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to find and hire great talent fast. In fact, in the minute I've been talking to you, 23 hires were made on Indeed, according to Indeed data worldwide. And listeners of the show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/to-do list. Just go to Indeed.com/to-do list right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/to-do list. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
If you enjoy Beyond the To-Do List, I invite you to check out Best Laid Plans. I'm Sarah Hart Unger, the host of Best Laid Plans, a podcast devoted to all things planning and planning adjacent. I talk about everything from paper planner reviews to deep dives into all things productivity, from keeping track of goals and tasks to fitting in your true priorities and reducing the stress around planning and organizing across different areas of life. I am a practicing physician and mother of three, so I have a lot going on in my own life and am intimately familiar with the time constraints that impact us all. And I love sharing my own productivity strategies and learning from others who have their own ideas to share. I invite you to check out Best Laid Plans, available on all podcast platforms, or visit my website, theshoebox.com. theshubox.com to learn more.
So I think the next piece here, the argument section or grouping of elements, is the one where I think a lot of people jump to when they think the word persuade. They think, oh, you're going to argue with me. Okay, fine. Let's have at it. But that's not exactly what you mean.
Not at all. An argument has, again, seven pieces. For example, logic, use deduction, induction, these kinds of techniques that lawyers learn or philosophers learn. That's one thing. There is call to authorities. So this expert agrees with me, right? So that's the call to authority. There are things like laws and standards. So the law says this is the right thing. Or we have community standards. This is a big term of a couple of decades ago, right? So the value to this community, right? American values, that's the call to standards, right? So you've got evidence, witnesses. The problem that we have with this is that most people have been taught not to use character and they don't know how to use emotion. And so they go back, they're stuck kind of with argument, and almost everyone I've ever coached, otherwise very professional success people, what I tell them is this: persuasion is a ship with three masts on which two sails are tightly wound up. There's one sail that's open, it's called argument, and it's tattered because it's doing all the work. So you may want to lower that, open the other two. The boat's going to move a lot faster and get you a lot farther than just in this poor raggedy sail that's trying to do all the work. And I say, especially to tech people, right, scientists and technology people, the more persuaded you are by argument, the farther away you are from persuading the average person.
Interesting. So why would you say that? And I think a lot of people would say, because they look at argument, they look at things like logic and especially evidence. Although if we go back to some of the things we were talking about earlier with technology and the way that plays into things and can be, air quotes, faked, that's a little circumspect these days. But evidence, if it's concrete, it's proven, it's factual, then how can you argue against that?
The problem with with evidence is that it's very hard to build correctly. Argument is hard to use. That's why people go to law school for years, where they get PhDs in philosophy. Otherwise, you would just become a philosopher just because you decide to become a philosopher. Like being a writer, anybody can be a writer, okay? There's no writer's test pass to publish a book. You write it, and that's that. That's a little different with being a logician, right? There's actually formal training in logic. So putting together argument, putting together cohesive logical sequences is a difficult thing. And what happens is people who aren't trained in this have a hard time following. So what happens with argument is that when it fails, right, it creates confusion at best, and I say in the book, and chaos at worst. And so if you're not in control of those pieces, a lot of us have been in a meeting where after 2 minutes, someone talking, you go, I have no idea, where are you going with this, right? And it's just been a minute or two, and I'm already lost because argument is difficult to build well. And by the way, even professional argument people, lawyers, case after case where it falls apart, right? The case fall apart. They were winning, then they're losing because they couldn't keep it together. So it's difficult to build correctly, difficult to follow. And because of that is why we place so much weight on character and emotion.
Well, and ideally using a combination of all 3/all 21 is really what's going to yield the actual or the best results with, I don't want to say the least amount of effort, but the least amount of struggle in the effort, maybe a better way to put it. I don't know.
Think of it as like the highest level of efficacy, right? You're not probably going to have all 21 because there's no medicine that has every element on the periodic table. But what you want to have is the right combination. And I talk in the book about examples of people who were good at putting all three. Just do it. One of my favorite, right? Almost always rated the number one tagline in history, at least in the U.S., and I explained to people that I think it's that because it's all three things. It's an argument, technically a counter argument, because you give all the reasons for why you're not going to work out today. And Ike says, yeah, don't care. Just do it. Okay. My counter argument. All right. It is a statement about character. It says, listen, weak people stay in bed when it's cold outside. People who are admirable, people who are strong, get up and go run. Which one are you? And then it's emotional. It says, don't you want to win? Don't you want to feel the thrill of victory? Right? So it's beautiful and it's beautifully persuasive because all three things in one. The other example I talk about in the book is the Gettysburg Address. If you look at Gettysburg Address and I color coded, right? Character, argument, and emotion. I think there are only two sentences that are not color coded. Everything else falls into one of these three things, which is why it's only 2.5 minutes long. And yet, it's the greatest speech in American history.
So speaking of emotion, I know that's one we haven't dove into yet. What are the elements of emotion? Because I think that's the other one that I think a lot of people are thinking. Argument first, maybe emotion, then maybe character. But of course, that's a misconception as well.
So emotion has things like there are positive emotions, happiness, joy, right? There are negative emotions, hatred, indignation, anger. You've got emotions that are exhortative. Once a call to action, join me, let's roll. There are emotions that are contemplative. They slow the brain down. that causes nostalgia, for example. You stop, you recall, and you think, right? There are emotions that are inspirational. And inspiration means to create desire, to convince someone that they lack something, right? And then there are mystical emotions, which are emotions that you feel but can't quite explain. And then there are religious emotions, which are emotions that accompany religious experience, right? And they are built to augment theology, right? Or theological events, or religious events, better said. So they're very powerful things.
Now, you're bringing forward from the past these elements, these modes, and not just crossing time, but crossing space. These cross boundaries of cultures, they're principled in their elemental status, in other words.
I think so, and I argue so. And in the book, I use examples from classical Chinese poetry, for example, and Confucian philosophy and logic. And so these are, my opinion, universal things that are about human beings. They're not about Greeks, right? They're not about antiquity. They're about people. And in fact, there's a section in my book where I look at five case studies, right? The first one is the Dialogues of Plato. The second one is the first 10 years of Muhammad, right? So the creator of Islam had to leave Mecca to go into exile early on because he wasn't wanted there by the powers that be. So he spends several years in exile, but eventually returns triumphantly. During that period of time, he converts the first generation of Muslims. How did he persuade that first generation, the people who are the ancestors religiously of today's, you know, worldwide Muslim population? I look at the Chinese posters in during the rise of communist China, during the Mao era, because you've got a 1. Something billion people, most who are illiterate. There's no social media. There's no TV. You've got radio, but radio's expensive. So how do you reach a majority of people that has no electronic media, can't read? You do it through posters, through art, right? And so there's a whole chapter that I was able to access the poster collection at a university in England. They were very nice to let me use it. And then I look at a couple other examples. Well, the last one I look at is this, it's a video on YouTube, which is Kevin Costner's eulogy of Whitney Houston. You know, where Whitney Houston died. Of course, he had starred with her in The Bodyguard, and he hadn't spoken about her publicly and all her issues. And he was invited by her family to come in and speak at the funeral in New Jersey. And if you haven't seen the video, it's wonderful. It's one of the great pieces of modern American oratory. It's a very ancient form of eulogy. It goes back to antiquity. And so rise of Islam, Chinese posters, Platonic dialogues. Oh yeah. And I look at Marvin Gaye's What's Going On, the album.
Yeah.
Another wonderful, it's this art musical creation, but the rules are all there. When I wrote the book, I just thought it was a great example. And then I went and found out that it had become Rolling Stone's greatest album, rock and roll album of all time, which didn't surprise me. I agree with that. Yeah. And then I answered with Kevin Costner. So all very different people, very different places, the rules at work and all of them.
I think what that speaks to, all those different examples, they're all spokes pointing to that hub of different combinations of the elements as to why this transcends. Sometimes it's overly visual or iconic, like the posters. Sometimes it's communal and religious, like Muhammad. Sometimes it's, although I'd say sometimes I'm thinking of my experience, not as much these days, but more so back in, say, high school, college, where you would have a visual of you're sitting there opening the liner notes to something that's a music album, as it used to be known as, right? And you've got your headphones on and you're listening to it and you're hearing the emotion. You're following the lyrics, which is potentially logical, but definitely different chemistry of all of these elements. And so I think that's something people can relate to.
Yeah. And what you're talking about there as well is the delivery, right? So medicine, once again, back to chemistry, look, I can make a medicine, but sometimes we give it to you in a pill. Sometimes it's liquid. Sometimes it's a shot. And this is a patch. So the chemistry is the chemistry. But how I give it to you can vary. We give kids, little kids, medicine in certain ways that we don't do for adults and vice versa. So the formula is one part, but then you say, well, how am I going to deliver it? Right. And it's another problem because the easiest delivery mechanism for human beings, just like the spoonful of sugar in Mary Poppins, is a story, right? Story narrative is a chemistry delivery device, and all narrative is change over time. The question becomes, okay, do I deliver this to you in a very analytical report? Do I deliver it to you in a story? Do Do I let someone else tell a story, which is a calling on your witnesses, right? Do I show you pictures? They work in certain ways, right? And so the great communicators know not just what's the right formula, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, but they are also very good at deciding, how do I deliver this to you, depending on when I'm communicating to you, right, and who the audience is. So, and I think that's what's really interesting, that it's, that's why it's a different experience. If you listen to Dark Side of the Moon without reading the lyrics, or if you read the lyrics without listening to the music, or if you do both simultaneously, there are three different ways, right, to experience or to absorb the message that Waters and company were sending through that particular piece of art. And so the delivery mechanism becomes the other thing, right? Good message delivered in the wrong way.
Or if you take it another step further and sync up the album with The Wizard of Oz.
I haven't done that. You know, I have seen movies without visuals. I'm a movie junkie, and I study movies. And so I and especially the sound of movies. So my favorite movie to watch without just to listen to it, say, is Alien. Right. So the Ridley Scott classic, and to listen to Alien, in my opinion, is scarier than to watch Alien. It's just wonderful sound construction. And again, sound activates certain emotions, right? And because you don't have sight, your brain goes into things that it won't do if you're seeing what, if you hear a tapping and you don't know what it is, that's scary. And if you just see somebody working on a utility pole, take the image of the worker off and you just hear the sound, your brain will then begin to fill in, well, what if that's somebody breaking into the house, right? So it's funny how that works. You can, certain things augment emotional reactions, which then play into this whole question of the persuasive chemistry once again.
Yeah. You saying Alien and the listening to it versus watching it makes me go, and then the opposite end of that spectrum is like the Quiet Place movies where you're seeing things, but you're on the edge of your seat because you're like straining to hear anything as a clue in that sense as well. So
right, you're starved of sound. So yes. Your eye being asked to do a job they normally don't do. So it's like when you're watching through a window, this is Rear Window, right? Because your eyes are looking for other cues of what's going on, but all you have is the visual input, which, you know, alters, right, what you see and what you believe you're seeing.
Now, of course, they're doing that intentionally. They are leaning into that. And that gets to what you're talking about with the different components as well as the delivery. How would somebody start to decipher, okay, I have this message or I have this thing I want to persuade either one or many people of, and I need to decipher how I can go about, one, best combining the right components and then the right delivery method?
The most important thing is to know that there are three modes. Again and again, so much of what I do is get people out of the everything is done through argument mode, right? Which is almost always what I find. And I tell, imagine that there are three dials and they all go up from, you know, from 0 to 10, right? The perfectly persuasive message is a 30 score. I find that people, when I meet them, they're like a 6 or a 7. Within a couple of weeks, we're at 14, right? When we're finished, we're in the 20s. And so a very simple question would be, what element in the character list, I don't care what it is, any of the 7, just pick one, that if you existed, if you added to the formula, it would make you more persuasive, right? So just ask that very simple question. Just make a list. Is there anything here that I have? And there always is, at least so far in my experience. And once you find it and you include it in the formula can be completely transformed. And I'll give you a real example if you want. This happened to me a couple of weeks ago. So I'm coaching someone who started a nonprofit in Hawaii. It does environmental cleanup, specifically inside the ocean. So reefs. She's a very successful person, was a doctor, retired early, moved to Hawaii. Now she's doing media interviews about the foundation because it's done great work. So I asked her, when somebody asks you, why'd you start this? What do you say? And she gives a very, very analytical person, very smart, very logical. Well, I retired. I wasn't home. My kids had left. I wanted to do something, et cetera. Very concrete, step-by-step thing. But it doesn't really affect anyone besides, other than you intellectually know why she did this. And then I said, okay, let's try it again. But I want you to find something in your history. Go back when you were a little girl. Just tell me something about you that connects to this foundation. So she thought about it for a minute and then she said, okay, how about this? This is true. When I was a little girl growing up in Puerto Rico, I used to watch a show called Jacques Cousteau. And Jacques Cousteau was a show with this French guy, used to run around the world, diving into the ocean. And I just thought it was the most amazing life. And I used to sit spellbound in front of the TV watching Jacques Cousteau. And I wanted to be Jacques Cousteau. Fortunately, my family had other plans, so I became a doctor. But the moment I stopped being a doctor, I moved to Hawaii and I signed up for diving classes. And I wanted to be a fish photographer. So I started diving, but I'm the world's worst fish photographer. All my photographs were just tail. And one day I went out and I would go to the same place where there was this coral reef and I had all these tails. And one day there were no fish. And I looked up and I saw the reef. And I realized why I could come back to the same spot. It wasn't the fish. It was the reef. It was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen. And at that instant, I decided I'm going to spend the rest of my life protecting this place. And I said, that's the story. All right. That's the story. And your foundation was born, not when you created it, but the state of Hawaii. It was born the first time you turned on the TV and you saw Jacques Cousteau. That's its origin. Tell me that story and I'll help you any way I can. Tell me the first story. Not that interested, but there it was, right? It was right there. It just took one question. And then suddenly and I can't tell it as well as she can. It's a beautiful tale, right? Of how this wonderful thing came to be. So that's an example of just asking yourself a very simple question. What in Hawaiian would get you to believe?
That is a great question. That's a really great question. I hadn't thought about that way. And of course, your story there lends credibility or persuasive element to the fact that story is honestly one of the most powerful ways to persuade.
I believe it's the original persuasive delivery mechanism. Way back before there was writing, there were stories. And so in the farthest recesses of our history as a species, the very first way we persuaded each other was probably through gestures, I guess, right? But even the gestures were a story. And so story is the original persuasion delivery mechanism. And it still works, right? It's still the best, right? When it's done, right? The other way, like I said, is emotion, right? I ask executives all the time where you go, like I work with startup founders who have the pitch decks. And I say, what do you want me to feel when you're done talking? Answer that question. And I tell you that people can answer that question. They never thought about it. I go, I don't know. I go, what do you want me to feel? Was it happy? Excited, relieved, thrilled, greedy. Pick an emotion out of the seven. Like if you want to feel something. So if you're not engineering it, then you're leaving it to chance. And great communicators don't leave things to chance, right? Just the way great chemists don't go, well, let's give it to them. Let's see what happens, right? They think this through. And so you want to know exactly what I'm going to feel because that is the closing part of this in many cases, right? When you stop talking, I start feeling. So what do you want me to feel? And that's what's important is anything else you're going to show me. I'm probably going to forget that. I'm not going to forget how I felt during that whole time you were talking. So those are the two most basic questions that we start with is what part of your story makes me want to believe you? And then what do you want the audience to feel? And then work as hard as that as on everything else you've got, if not more. Those two things can overcome all kinds of issues or weaknesses in the argument part, right? And we see politician after politician who, because they're white and because people feel good, they win elections. Even if their policies or logic are not always as great as they could be, it doesn't make a difference. At the end of the day, they persuade people, this is who should lead me.
On that note, I'm hoping that people are thinking and or feeling that they want to grab your book, and I'd love to point people to your site where they can find out more about you, but then also grab it.
Well, we go back to, I'll answer my own question. What do I always want someone to feel when I stop talking? And that is just curiosity, right? Well, I'd like to know more. And if you want to know more, you can find the book on Amazon. It's called The Rules of Persuasion. It's available in print. It's available on Kindle. It's on Audible. I did the narration for the audio version. It's also on audiobooks, which I'll never do again, brother. It's a nightmare. And then if you want to know more about my other publications, carlosalvarenga.com on the internet. That takes you to my site and you can see interviews but really more importantly, find about other things that I've written and are planned that are coming this year and next. If you have a question, you can contact me through the site as well.
That's great. I'm going to link up to your site and Amazon link to the book in the show notes. I'm also going to throw in, I'm going to find that YouTube video of Kevin Costner's eulogy of Whitney Houston, and maybe throw a link into the Rolling Stone best album, Marvin Gaye, What's Going On. One of my favorite albums, by the way. So perfect. Carlos, it's been great talking with you. Thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thank you so much for having me on. Thank you to our listeners for listening to our conversation. It's been a pleasure, and I wish everybody a great day.
Well, that's another podcast crossed off your listening to-do list. I hope that this conversation persuaded you to grab Carlos's book, The Rules of Persuasion. I gotta say, it is incredibly powerful. This, along with some of the other recent communication episodes that we've done on presentation and a few others, which I'll link up to in the show notes, are incredibly helpful because communication is so key to productivity. Think about how many times that you've been stuck trying to communicate across different channels to get people to see things from a certain perspective, and you're going about it the wrong way. And because of that, it is like spinning your RAM cycles and making you go crazy, and this can help. So I really hope you got something great out of this. And if you did, would you do me the favor of sharing this with someone that you know needs to hear it? Think of a coworker. Think of a friend. Think of the social media world at large and share it there. I don't know. In any of those instances, if this helped you, I would love for you to do me the favor of sharing this to help grow the show. If you're enjoying the show, I would love for you to help me grow this podcast. Thank you so much for sharing. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you next episode.